In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking with a fellow who has had a rather interesting life, certainly unconventional in a lot of ways. His name's John Francis, and when he was living in California in the early 1970s, there was a very bad oil spill in San Francisco Bay, and he was very moved by that, decided that he wanted to do something, take some action in his life that would be supportive of the environment in a positive sort of way. So he decided that he would give up driving. In fact, not only give up driving, he would give up riding in any motorized vehicle. And for a long time, he walked a lot. He walked everywhere. It was something, a decision that even people close to him seem not to have completely understood. And there was then another later decision that he made. It was even tougher for people around him to understand. And this started on his 27th birthday, where he decided just for the day that he would be totally silent. And then it went on another day, and it went into weeks, and it went into months, and in fact, it eventually lasted for 17 years. Also, over the same period of time, he continued to do a lot of walking, got some advanced college degrees, and became well known as an environmentalist. He now continues to make his home in California, and has changed his life back again in some ways, because indeed he does now drive and ride in airplanes. And he does that so that he can travel, and he does do an awful lot of traveling to talk about the experience of pilgrimage and what that can mean to people. He's now the founder and director of Planet Walk, which is a nonprofit environmental education organization, and indeed travels around the world talking about pilgrimage and change. He has authored a book that is a memoir of his life and experiences that's titled Planet Walker. The subtitle is How to Change Your World One Step at a Time, and it's published by Elephant Mountain Press. He's joining us this morning by telephone. He was here, by the way, on campus a few weeks ago, and we just weren't able to talk with him while he was here, but we indeed wanted to talk, and he said, yeah, he'd be happy to do that. So he's joining us this morning by phone, and as we talk, questions and comments are certainly welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's for local folks. We do also have a toll-free line, and that's good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. At any point here, you can join in. People who are around Illinois and Indiana. In fact, if you're listening on the internet, as long as you're in the United States, you could also use that toll-free line, 800-222-9455. Mr. Francis, hello.
Hey, David, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks. And yourself?
Oh, very good. Very
good. Well, we appreciate you talking with us today.
Oh, no, I'm happy to do it. I'm sorry I couldn't do it while I was on campus at the walking symposium.
Well, we're sorry, too. It's always nice to actually have the chance to meet people in person and have them in the studio, but, you know, it's not always possible, so this is kind of the next best thing.
And, well, it's good that I'm talking now, right?
Yes, it would have been a little bit difficult to have you a guest on our show if you weren't talking. It's a fascinating story, I think. And, let's just go back, and maybe I could have you talk a little bit about what you were thinking about way back in 1971, as I explained, there was this very bad oil spill in the bay in San Francisco. And you seemed to have this feeling like you were very affected by this and you wanted to do something. You wanted to take some kind of action in your life that would at least address, you know, the issue of the environment and what we were doing to it. So how did the idea occur to you? And it probably wasn't really a fully formed idea right at the beginning, that maybe the thing to do would be just to walk and use that as the way that you got around.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, it was it's something that happened, I guess, over time. But you know, like being on the highways and the freeways during rush hour and being slowed down in traffic. There's been many times when you know I've said to myself, "Gee, I wish I didn't have to be here." And so just to set something, there's a foundation for, you know, liking to be in a car, driving, getting where you're going, but also there's a frustration about it too. There are things that you miss, and we just give those things up. Sometimes we go hiking and we go on a long walk, and we come back to the car and we realize that, well, okay, we're back in our car now, but we did, you know, have this wonderful experience walking in the park or, you know, nature or somewhere. So when the oil spill happened, you know, there was something in me that said, you know, hey, you could not ride in a motorized vehicle. There was something that was there already. The oil spill was the first environmental insult that I ever experienced that I just couldn't turn away from, that I couldn't turn the page or change the channel. And even when I turned away, you could smell it. It was so overwhelming and so overpowering. And I said at the time, I said to my girlfriend, you know, maybe we could not ride in cars, and making the connection that there's oil in the vehicle and there's oil now in the water. And she turned to me and said, yeah, right. It was kind of a joke. And she said, that would be really nice, except we don't have lots of money. And if we had lots of money, then we could do it, because if we did it while we were poor, people would just say, you know, look at those crazy people. But if we did it when we had lots of money, people might say, oh, I wonder what they must know. And people would listen to us. And so it seems like a very, you know, just a kind of a crazy thing. I mean, you know, you're not going to ride in cars anymore. And so it was just an idea at the time of the oil spill. We didn't do it. Mm-hmm. I mean, we just drove off and said, yeah, that sounds like, you know, we'll wait for the money to come. And the money was going to make it available for us to do. It would make it possible for us to take the time to walk. That's what it was. The money would really give us the time to do what we thought we should be doing. Isn't that odd?
Yeah. It's the stories you tell, particularly early on, make it a couple of things really clear. One thing that it makes clear is that, in fact, this was not easy. This was not, you might think, well, that wouldn't be that difficult a thing to do. But I don't know if this is something particular to California. It's probably not. Mm-hmm. And when you think about all the ways in which we depend on cars, or maybe even people, you know, people travel by public transportation.
Right.
If you decided that what you were going to do is you're going to say, no, I'm going to, any place I'm going to go on foot. This is actually not easy.
It's not easy, and it's not easy to make the decision to do that, you know. I mean, to really make the decision, to really commit yourself to it. And that didn't come until I had an experience where a friend in our community, and we lived in a very small community in Point Reyes National Seashore called Inverness. And Inverness, California, had a population of maybe about 300 or so in the winter. And in the summer, it might have grown to about 1,000. But everybody knew everybody, and a deputy sheriff lost his life in Tamaulipas Bay, and I, you know, write about that in great detail. But what happened was, he was about the same age. I guess we were about 26, and he was 26. He had a family. I didn't, and he had I thought a good job as a deputy sheriff, and wife and kids and a house with a white picket fence around it. I mean, he seemed to have everything. And one morning somebody came and told me, you know, Jerry was lost in the bay, in Tamaulipas Bay. It was a long, narrow, shallow bay that the wind came up from a certain direction from the south, and it's very treacherous, and he lost his life there. And in an instant, you know, I said to my girlfriend at the time, I said, well, look, let's do something. We'll pick some vegetables for his mother, and then we'll take a walk. And we went for a 25-mile walk to a place called San Anselmo, where the Youngbloods were playing. The Youngbloods are a group that formed this. They lived out where we did, and they had a music hit, you know, Come On People, Smile On Your Brother, Everybody, Get Together, that was the name of that song.
Yeah, I remember.
And so we went walking there, you know, had no idea. We left in the afternoon. We went walking to celebrate Jerry's life, and at about 2 o'clock in the morning, we kind of rolled into town walking into San Anselmo, and the band was over. The music was over, and they said, oh, my goodness, John Gene, you guys walked all that way. Come on, we'll give you a ride back. Well, we decided that since we'd already walked there, we wanted to spend some time there, and we were going to walk back. It's on the way back I decided that walking back, it came to me that, you know, waiting for the ship to come in or the, you know, the money to come so that you could do the thing that you think was what you should be doing, there's really no guarantee that that's going to happen. And in fact, there's no guarantee that you're going to wake up, that something's not going to happen to you. And that's what I got from Jerry dying so suddenly. And that if there's something that you really believe that you need to do, maybe you should do it and do it the best way that you can. And for me, that was walking. And so it wasn't really an easy decision. You know, it took a lot. It took someone's death. It took some realization. And then when I got back to our home in Inverness, I had to. It took me a while to understand what walking really meant. And you know, looking at California, where everything is highways and freeways and great distances, walking became a very difficult thing. I mean, for me to get to the town where we could go shopping was a 4-mile walk, and that's 4 miles one way and 4 miles the other way. That's 8 miles, so that was a whole day for me. I'd walk to town and I'd walk back, and people are still driving, and we're not set up for this walking thing, so people are still driving and passing me on the road, and you know, going, John, you want a lift? And I'm, no, I'm walking, you know, and. Okay, and if you want to play volleyball, you got to walk over to the gym, and that's a 4-mile walk and a 4-mile back again, while people take 5 minutes to get there. So, you know, you have to adjust your, I had to adjust my head to accept that it was going to be different and very difficult in that sense.
The other thing that is really striking when you tell the story is how people reacted to what you were doing, and I guess I would think, you know, if there would be any place there people would be receptive to this kind of ambition, it would be in California. But in fact, people, they may indeed have thought that you were a little unhinged, but it seemed that in some cases people were downright angry, as if they took it as some kind of personal criticism of them, the fact that you were doing this, and that reaction seemed kind of surprised me. I mean, I can understand if they thought that you were just crazy, but for them to be angry about it, that seems kind of surprising.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it surprised me too, and after I lived with it for a while, then I could understand it. But at first, you know, there I am walking, and people would stop and ask me, "What am I? You know, what are you doing? You want to ride?" And I'd say, "No, I'm walking." And they'd say, "Well, you know, why?" When I can give you a ride to Point Reyes, and I'd say, "Well, I'm walking because of that oil spill, you know, and that I don't want to contribute to to oil in the marine environment," and that would get them, and it would get them because at one time when the spill happened, there was a lot of talk about people, you know, by people in town wanting to give up their driving their automobiles. I mean, it was a kind of a visceral thing that happened when you smelled the oil and made the connection to yourself driving an automobile. And I expected, and there's another dynamic here. I guess when I gave up riding in cars, I expected other people to do the same thing. And so the dynamic that was set up was me expecting other people to follow. You know, come on, let's go. We're all gonna walk. Well, that didn't happen. That didn't happen. And so, I think that I kind of carried, even if I didn't carry it out visibly by condemning people for riding in their cars, inwardly I must have thought, I did think, you know, gee, they should be walking with me. You know, so that set up a dynamic that reflected on me as, well, people got angry, and, you know, thinking that maybe I was making a criticism of them, you know, of them, and actually I probably was, you know, but silently. I didn't say it out loud, you know, and so I realized that I get into arguments with people, and I realized I didn't really know what I was talking about. I didn't really understand how my walking was really going to make a difference, and I didn't really understand what this whole environmental thing was. I mean, I made this decision on the environment when I really didn't get it, and so in not getting it, I decided that, wow, I find myself walking, I'm arguing with people, I really have to do something about that. And on my 27th birthday, that's when I decided I was going to take a vow of silence for one day. And I did, and that changed everything. Because the first thing I learned, I mean, everybody was grateful for a little while. But, you know, then they thought that was strange, too. And you, like you had mentioned, it was California. And, yeah, it is California. And so a lot of people thought that I was, a sign that the end of the world was near, that I was walking and not talking. And they said, uh-oh, something, you know, is happening. For me, the first thing that I got out of not speaking was that I learned that I hadn't been listening to anyone. That I'd just been arguing, and it really takes two to have an argument, and I was the other person making the argument. So I, from one day, it would go a little longer. You know, I'd say, well, maybe I should do it for another day, and then there were some people who thought, well, gee, John is just really crazy, he just really is, and some people thought it was just a neat thing, and I was still. You know, I didn't know. It was an experiment that each day I learned something more, that I hadn't been listening, that I, if I listened to people, I could learn something, that people really had things to say if you could get past your own inability to hear them. And I mean inability that someone else might say something that you didn't understand or that you didn't believe or all those things. And so I made a decision at one point, I guess after being silent a month, because in my head was an argument saying, you got to start talking. Hey, come on, what are you doing? And I said, okay, I'm going to do this for a year. And as soon as I said that and made the commitment to not speak for a year, the arguments I had about when am I going to start talking just went away. I just took that off the table, so to speak, and became silent for a year. And each year, on my birthday, I would revisit that decision. So it lasted 17 years, over 17 years.
Our guest this morning is John Francis. He now makes his home in Point Reyes Station, California. He's the founder and director of Planet Walk. It's a nonprofit environmental education organization. And now travels around the world speaking on pilgrimage and change and on Planet Lines. That's an environmental studies curriculum based on the walking pilgrimage that he's developing for schools. He has authored a book that's his story, his life story, that he describes these events and more. It's titled Planet Walker, How to Change Your World One Step at a Time. Elephant Mountain Press is the publisher. He was here on the campus not very long ago to take part in a kind of a program that is sponsored by a number of units on the campus, Fine and Applied Arts, Center for Advanced Study, Environmental Council, School of Art and Design, Granite Art Museum, others. I'm afraid I'm going to leave somebody out and somebody's going to get upset. That's a series of programs bringing speakers here to talk. And the overall theme, they're calling it Walking as Knowing as Making, a Peripatetic Investigation of Place. And it really does center around walking and, talking to people about the opportunity, saying to take the opportunity to have a little bit more personal contact with nature. And the ways in which we separate ourselves from it, and how by doing something very simple as getting out and walking gets you back in touch.
All right.
And questions, comments certainly are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. We do have someone here who would like to talk with you, John. So we'll go to the phones and a caller in Urbana on line one. Hello.
Hello. Good morning. I just wanted to ask the speaker, what kinds of personal gains, besides recognizing giving up walking as well as speaking, did he feel that he gained in sort of understanding the world? Because it seems that the idea of the pilgrimage is seemingly unusual in the U.S. because we're not a Catholic country, at least religiously. And pilgrimages are as old as the Middle Ages, and in many places in the world, at various historical moments or times, people walk. But the idea of not speaking can be a space of sort of looking at the world through a different lens. And there are various ways that even we in this country walk, which is the march, which is the idea of not just an individual walker, but a group walking for a particular purpose. So I'm curious as to these seemingly spiritual, personal actions of giving up. How does that sort of transform his idea of collective politics?
That's an interesting question. And I guess I understand that there are group walks, and when we were in Champaign, Urbana, just recently, I was with Dennis Banks, who was with Ames, the American Indian Movement. He's one of the founders, and we went on a walk that the Potawatomi, is that correct?
Potawatomi.
Potawatomi Indians, who actually walked, were displaced, and in a displacement, there were a lot of deaths that happened. They were moved from, I think, Kansas, and so there's, I mean, political overtones to a lot of the walks that people do together. What happened with me is that even though one person walks, you really affect all the people around you, even if they're not walking. And I learned that it's like being silent in a community. You put yourself in the reality of everyone else, and you don't do it. I didn't do it in a malicious way. It's just that's what we all do. Whatever we do, our reality is forced upon whoever is in our sphere of influence. And so as I walked across the country, just personally, in my own personal walk, I found that myself going to school and getting my advanced degrees and still not speaking, and that's, I understand what the caller mentioned about it gives you a certain window that's different onto the world. But however, I still walked across the country, and when I got to the other side of the country, having no idea that this was going to happen, I found that I had a PhD in environmental studies and land resources, and I had written on oil spills because that was my interest. This is something that I did, and no one was interested in oil spills. But when I reached the other side of the country, it was 1989 or 1990, but the Exxon Valdez had happened, and all of a sudden, everybody in the United States wanted to know about oil spills, and the government wanted to know about oil spills, and there was only one person in the United States studying oil spills at a PhD level and how to cost them, and that was me.
And, wow.
And I had no idea that I would be there, but it was just to take your own personal step, you know, taking that personal step and just following it and hoping and having faith that you will make you are going to make some impact in the world, because we all are making an impact in the world in everything we do, and that we can do it together, that's even more. But you personally have to make your first step in changing your world. And is that a answer to your question?
Yes, and just one comment and I'll go off air.
Mm-hmm.
I'm actually a grad student, and I find it very useful as a way of decompressing for the week or the day
mm-hmm.
to not speak for a weekend and live in my own company. And it grants, and I have the ability to do that being without a family or a partner, but I find it to be the greatest piece of solace to continue about the daily routine just in silence.
It's wonderful.
So, thank
you. Well, thanks for the call. Let's go and talk with someone else. This caller is in Champaign and line two. Hello.
Hello. I just have one question, especially when you first got started, and maybe you answered, I didn't hear the very beginning of the program. But your protest was against the oil spills. But why did you choose not to ride a bike for some of this transportation?
Mm-hmm. I let people say that it was my protest, but I guess it was a protest. But I kind of thought it was more of a lifestyle change for me, and that's where I was going with it. That it was just a lifestyle change, and I didn't ride bicycles at first, because I wanted to walk, and I just wanted to see what that was like. And I think bicycles, if we look at, you know, non-motorized vehicles, they're right up there. I think they are number one as far as being efficient and non-polluting. But at that time, I just wanted to move slow. I wanted to move at the 3 miles an hour. And eventually, I did start to use bicycles when I walk somewhere, and like, for example, I walked from my home in California to Missoula, Montana, or to Port Townsend, Washington, and I built a wooden boat up there to row across Puget Sound and to sell. But while I was in the town, I had a bicycle and I would ride around.
Okay.
And then I would walk to Montana, and I was going through wilderness and all over different places. And when I got to Missoula, and while I attended school there, I had a bicycle and I would ride around town.
Because it just seems, especially if you're shopping for groceries and things, and maybe you grew all your own, I don't know, it would be a practical thing to have a bicycle, too.
Oh, yeah. I think that bicycles are really very good to have. The other thing is that when I first started, walking, just to survive was there just weren't any bicycles. No one had a bicycle. This is back in 1971, 72.
Mm-hmm.
And bikes were not as popular as they are now. I mean, I could walk back and forth from my town to San Francisco, and I might see one bicycle, maybe. But over the years, like since 76 or something like that, there's been an explosion in recreational use and of bicycles.
Yeah, the other thing I did understand when you were talking about your I don't walk as much as you do, but I enjoy walking.
Mm-hmm.
But when you were talking about infringing on other people's lives, too, I like to take my own tote bags to the grocery store. Maybe that's my little bitty contribution.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And now it's gotten a little bit easier. I don't see many people doing it, but at least the clerks don't usually look at me like I'm a freak anymore.
No. I mean, and that's what, I mean, and we all are looking at each other, and we're all learning and teaching each other.
Yeah.
So everything that we do, all the things that you do, you know, people are looking at you. You're looking at people. We're all getting something from each other.
Okay. Well, thank you.
All right. Thanks
You're
for
welcome.
The call. Other comments and questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. You talk in the book about how this sort of project grew, and about how your walking expanded, and how maybe in the beginning you were walking around the place where you lived, and then you mm-hmm. walked to Oregon and back a couple of times, and then it just sort of expanded and grew, and about the vow of silence that you took on your 27th birthday and how you renewed that annually and eventually went 17 years. Mm-hmm. One of the things that you set as a goal for yourself after, and this had been, I think, 6 years into this time that you were not speaking, you said, well, I want to finish my college degree, which you did, and then when, as you say, you went on and got this PhD. And I think, I hope I remember this right, during all this time, you still weren't speaking.
Right.
How do you do that? How do you get a PhD? And I think you were even a TA. How do you do that? How do you go through grad school and get a PhD and not talk?
Well, you know, there's a couple of things here. One is that you're not speaking, but it doesn't mean you're not communicating. Mm-hmm. And a lot of what our communication is listening. And being able to listen to professors and to read and to think critically, and sometimes it's not a lot of talking really necessary. Professors loved me, I guess. Sit and listen to them chat all day. But I would have to act things out. I mean, I would always sit in the front of the class, and I'd always have to meet with the professor before the class started, so that they would know that this wasn't a joke and that I wasn't trying to disrupt their class or anything like that. And usually I had no problem convincing them that, you know, I could take their courses and that I would do the work. And that's all they cared about. And that I did things a little differently. For some professors, I know for my major professor who said it was just so new for him, something different, so different for him, that he'd been a professor for many, many years, and, you know, 30 years or so, and that this was something that he'd never experienced before, that somebody came in and had a vow of silence, but wanted to go to school and wanted to study. And so there was an acceptance in some sides of the university, and then there was, questioning on the other. And you had to deal with both. You know, you accept one, and you just have to deal with the people that were skeptical. Hmm.
Something that I'm sure that people hearing the story and reading the story it's difficult somehow to try to put yourself into your place and imagine what that would be like. And I guess really the only way to know what it would be like would be to do it. And I think that you say that it's very difficult to describe if someone says to you, well, gee, what's it like not to talk for 17 years? And there's no real easy way to explain to somebody else what that is like.
No, I could say, you know, read the book, but that's not even it. You know, it's just you have to do it, or you have to do some bit of silence, you know, to understand what silence is, and then maybe then stretch that to 17 years, or go to school for a year without speaking. Whatever, you know, you have to. It's very difficult to say exactly what it is. It is one of those things where you have to experience it.
Was it early on? Was it difficult in the sense that you had to continue to remind yourself that that's what the project was about, and that eventually you got to the point where you didn't really think about that anymore? You didn't go around every day thinking, I am not speaking. I am not speaking.
Mm-hmm. Well, about maybe five times three times in the course of the first year of silence, I didn't have to think too hard about it. Mm-hmm. But I would wake up and I would think, gosh, I'm not speaking. I'm still not speaking. And it would be like a month. And every day would be something which was just beyond my own comprehension. And I guess I had, for other people, it was, you know, God, John's not speaking, and that's pretty strange or pretty amazing. But for me, every new day became another amazing day. And once I, you know, was in a grocery store, and I bumped into someone, and I said, excuse me. And I was like, gee, did I say that? And I wasn't sure I said it, you know? Mm-hmm. And I was, then another time I was watching the television, and it was the Ten Commandments on the television, and it was Charlton Heston. And there he was Moses. and he raised his hands out, and the Red Sea parted, and I said, I was sitting there, and I said, oh, my God. and I go, did I say that? Well, I wasn't sure I said it. But and those are like those are the only times. So the other time was I was sitting on a dock in Marshall, California, which is a little town near us, and I'm sitting on a dock where I actually was sleeping there, on this dock that I near a restaurant, and I had been playing music the day before. I play the banjo, and that's one of the things I carry a banjo with me, and so I've been carrying this banjo with me, and I played it there, and I made a little money, and I had some dinner, and I went out on the dock on Tamales Bay, and I went to sleep for the night. And some kids came by in the morning, and they were playing around in the morning, and it's so funny that I knew them, and they're Kim and David, and so they're about 7 or 8, you know. And they came up to me, and there I am sleeping, and they said, oh, John, hey, John, what are you doing? So they woke me up, and I look at them, and I said, I'm exercising gravity. And they went, oh, okay. And they walked off, and they ran off, and later they went to their mother, and they said, Ma, John Francis talks. He talks. She says, what did he say? He says, I don't know. She says, you know John Francis doesn't talk. Don't you go around spreading rumors like that. Well, now it's like, you know, 30 years later, I tell them that story. They tell me the story. They said, I knew you said something, and I told them what I said. And that was the only times I talked.
One of the things that really strikes me is that the people around you who were close to you, who cared about you, who were really sometimes having a difficult time, they were having a difficult time dealing with it. At the same time, they were trying to understand and support you. The thing that strikes me is that and several people told you they had dreamed about you talking.
Yeah. They had dreamed about me talking, but they could never tell me what I said. And once or twice I had dreams of me riding in automobiles, and I'd wake up, you know, in a sweat, like, oh my God, what's I doing in a car? But people would dream about me speaking, and they would come to me and tell me, and what it did, it seemed that it just really brought us very close. I don't know how to say it any other way, that it brought the community really closer, or brought me closer into the community.
We have about 15 minutes left. I have some calls I will get to. I want to introduce again our guest, John Francis. He lives in California, Point Reyes Station. He's founder and director of Planet Walk. It's a nonprofit environmental education organization. And now travels around the world speaking on pilgrimage and change. If you're interested in reading his story, you can look for the book that he's written. It's titled Planet Walker, How to Change Your World One Step at a Time, published by Elephant Mountain Press. And it does indeed tell the story that we've been talking about how he was so moved by an oil spill in San Francisco Bay back in 1971 that he decided to give up riding in motor vehicles, which he did for a long, long time. And then because he had to spend so much time justifying what he was doing to people, on his 27th birthday, he decided for the day not to speak, to be silent. And then that eventually went into 2 days and a week and months and years, and he went on not speaking for 17 years. During that time, he continued to walk all over, got a couple of advanced degrees, and ended up getting a PhD. Did indeed one day start speaking again, does now ride in motor vehicles and flies in airplanes, because otherwise he could not do all the traveling that he does to do the speaking that he does. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And we have some other callers here. Next, someone in Urbana. This is line one.
Okay.
Hello?
Yeah, from a practical standpoint, how did you make a living?
A living, yeah. You have to do that, too. Well, as I mentioned earlier, I did have a banjo.
Okay.
And so I played the banjo, and and as you get the book, you'll see that I drew and painted. I paint every day. Mm-hmm. And so I became an artist and a musician, and I supported myself with that. Now, when I went to school, I took out some loans when I first got my undergraduate. I finished rather quickly for an undergraduate degree for 2 years, and then I got fellowships and scholarships. I was a fellow at the University of Wisconsin for my PhD, and I tell you, that's a wonderful thing. And I was an Erasmus Award winner at the University of Montana. So a lot of my education was paid for that way, academic awards.
Yeah, the other point was that in terms of people's reaction, I wonder sometimes whether there's a little bit of a guilt, from the standpoint we all feel that in terms of the environment, in terms of driving, that maybe we should do something, and here's somebody that's gone the other extreme. I have a daughter who's first grandchild, 2 years old, and has been raised on organic food. And people, she's not saying this is what you should do, that kind of thing, but people feel uncomfortable sometimes. Her friends, they want to feed the baby candy, they want to feed, that kind of thing. And so I think there's sort of that same reaction when we come to, in terms of driving and, our lifestyle, that kind of thing. So anything that's a little bit new, a little bit different, people feel uncomfortable with it.
Right, right. I know when I worked at the Coast Guard, I did speak because I'd started speaking, but I didn't ride in cars. And so the Coast Guard had to deal with that. And I write about that in the book. I was up in Vermont when I finally got hired by the Coast Guard to come and help write oil pollution regulations, to be a project manager in Washington, and they wanted to send me a plane ticket to get me down there, just start right away. And I said, well, I don't fly in planes. They said, well, you can take the train, Dr. Francis. And I said, I don't use the train either. And they said, you don't ride in cars, do you, Dr. Francis? I said, no, I don't. They said, well, we'll get back to you. And I figured, well, that's that. But they called back the next day and they said, how can you get down here? We really need to have you here. And I said, well, I could ride my bicycle. And they said, how long would that take? And I calculated all the things I needed to do, and I grit my teeth and I said, 2 months. He said, we'll be waiting.
I'll be down.
So that's another thing I did. I worked at the Coast Guard and worked for the government. And I learned a lot by that, by institutions being flexible or institutions changing, and how institutions change and what you can learn from the institution that you want to change, and how to address the institution that you want to change, that you're not really against the institution. You want the institution to exist. And you also want to change it, and so there's a dialogue that has to happen. It was very interesting, very, very educational for me.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. Let's go to Belgium nearby, line number 4. Hello.
Hello. I wanted to talk to you about the Point Reyes area. Last summer, I spent some time in Belinas and walking north along there. Belinas is an interesting little town, too.
Yeah, Belinas.
Yeah.
Yeah, they don't have a sign.
Yeah, they would. You can't find it unless you happen to stumble across it.
They don't want you to know where it is. That's the town where a lot of the oil came into.
Yes.
And a lot of people volunteered to clean up. And once they volunteered and they saw that little town, they stayed.
Yes. They have a fabulous bird sanctuary just up the coast from there. Just
right.
Not very far.
Bird Observatory, yeah.
Yeah, phenomenal. I mean, if people ever want to go see an amazing number of birds, there is an amazing number of birds in that place. And also walked up along the beach just north of Point Reyes, that long, narrow beach there.
Saw the Great Beach.
Oh, I hiked up that for days. It's just a
10-mile beach.
Pardon me?
There's 10 miles of, yes. of beach, wild beach.
Oh, yes. Fabulous, with tidal pools, and it's just the most amazing, beautiful place you can imagine.
Yeah.
I just want people to know that it's a phenomenal place to visit.
It's a national seashore.
Yes, it sure is. And it covers a great deal of area, too. I mean, it's a very large, I guess, is it a forest also there, too? Because it does go, it's not just the seashore, it covers a very large area.
Oh, yeah. There's lots of... it's, when you say seashore, it's not just the beach. No, it's a,
no.
It's a ridge and many ecosystems there.
It sure is. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. Let's talk with somebody else. This is someone listening in Charleston on our line number two. Hello.
Hi.
Yes. Thank you very much for taking my call. I was just wondering, did this fellow we're speaking to, is he normally mute or he just made himself mute? And how did he apply for student loan? How did he go to class? And how did he make a living during this period?
Yeah, we have sort of touched on some of those things,
yeah.
And indeed it was well, you can explain, John. But indeed it was a matter of choice. He was able to speak. He just decided not to.
Not to speak for 17 years.
Yeah, I think basically yes, that's right.
Yeah.
Well, maybe you could talk a little bit more, John, about how it is that you did, because you said something like not speaking, that doesn't mean not communicating, but then
yes.
how did you communicate with people?
Yes. With the instructors and the professors, how did he do it?
Yeah, particularly well, when you were in school.
Yeah, well, there's a couple things here I want to just bring in really quickly here. Mm-hmm. First of all, silence had been, like, just the idea of silence. I came to me from... an Eastern sadhu, Mahir Baba, who didn't speak for a long time. And he would say something like, be happy, or don't worry, be happy. And when I lived in Chicago many, many years, I came across Mahir Baba and that he didn't speak. And so silence was something that, like walking, that was a foundation somewhere. And I also wanted to become a Trappist monk at one point, a Cistercian monk. But I realized that the not speaking part, I didn't think I was ready for that, not speaking. When I did finally stop speaking, I established a lot of, I discovered a lot of our language is through gestures. And so I use a lot of gestures that people understand already. That we, when we talk with our hands, and I also use, I got a book by Iron Eyes Cody that had some Indian sign language, and I used that, and then I took some classes and just used mine, just acting things out, and so communication became a very creative endeavor, and that two people, or myself and a professor, or myself and a classmate, would agree to embark upon this something new. And so we would get into our conversation, our communication would be something that we would come to an agreement upon. We just didn't say things and then the other person just nod their head like they understood everything. It's that when I try to communicate with someone, the other person would play back to me what they felt. And maybe I could agree with that, and I would agree with it. In classrooms, we did the same thing. When I was a TA and we're in a discussion group, I would do some mime, and they would sit around and go, what is he saying? What's he saying? Well, I think he looks like he's sawing down the forest here. He must be talking about clear-cutting. And then someone else would say, no, that's selective forestry because he's using a handsaw. And someone says, no, you can do selective forestry or you can clear cut with a handsaw. And sometimes we would, you know, they would say things that, God, I didn't mean at all, but that I wish I had meant. And so I would learn as well. But we would always get to an agreement, and it came from all of us. And that was the way communication went. It wasn't me just saying something and everyone else nodding their heads and going, yep, okay, or not. That answer your question a little?
Yeah, thank you very much.
All right, thank you. One of the things, John, I wanted to make sure, and we're very close to being out of time.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk just a bit about Planet Walk?
Well, Planet Walk is the organization that I found, and it founded. It's an educational organization. It was founded in 1982, and it's a nonprofit. I would like to give an address, if I could,
sure.
If you're interested.
Sure.
If you're interested, you could write to me at P.O. Box 626, Point Reyes Station, California, 94956, and that's John Francis, or Planet Walk, or Elephant Mountain, because Elephant Mountain is also a part of Planet Walk. And what we're doing right now is developing this curriculum called Planet Lines. And Planet Lines is a curriculum that is based on a walking pilgrimage where students go on their own walk. They make their own journey. But at the same time, we're looking for looking at the environment and taking measurements of water, trees, air quality, all different kinds of things like that, that we use back in our classroom, and communicating with other students in other areas, doing this kind of the same thing. What's really an interesting thing that we're working with is someone's the visualization laboratory at the university, excuse me, not university, it's San Diego State University, the visualization lab, which we're kind of putting in all of the, in a geographic layout, all the lines that we're all making, and that's where planet lines come from, because as we make a walk, we're making our own planet line, our own planet walk. We have our own line. And on that line, we're looking at, an anecdotal detail, maybe what's happening in people's lives that you meet, pretty much like the book has been written, except it becomes your planet walk and your planet line. And that's what we're doing right now.
Well, we're going to have to stop there because we've used the time. I want to thank you, John, very much for talking with us. We appreciate it.
Let me say one thing.
Yes?
Pages for All Ages has the book.
Okay. If you want to read the book, Planet Walker, How to Change Your World One Step at a Time, you can go there, and it's also published by Elephant Mountain Press. Again, John Francis, thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you, David.